Chapter 15. In Search of Sanity. Perspective determines how we see and respond to any situation and guides us, or deceives us, to place it in one of two categories. It matters, or it doesn't matter. Picking the low-hanging fruit of a psychological assessment requires us to answer the following questions. Does this person have a balanced outlook on life's priorities, or does he blow little things out of proportion while perhaps ignoring the main things? Does he seem to know what is important and what is not, or does he live in a perpetual state of chaos and crisis where there is always something going on? Does she have an attitude of gratitude or expectation, or is she a constant blamer and complainer? Does he enjoy life despite the occasional setback, or is he just waiting for the next disaster to happen? If you notice that someone is constantly agitated over little things and excited over the trivial, pay attention. To the emotionally unwell person, every little thing is a big thing. Think about it. In any situation where you lack perspective, you have no way to tell whether or not something matters. Perspective provides context, and context allows for meaning. Without context, there is no recognition of, much less appreciation for, our challenges. A great deal is revealed by how someone responds to life's little losses and wins. But we do not need to wait and watch. Everyday conversation also provides a magnifying glass into a person's inner world. The lens of reality. An identifiable marker for perspective is revealed by how someone responds to and reflects on life's challenging experiences and even routine circumstances. Our perspective is typified by whether we organize our experiences through themes of contamination or redemption. The latter correlates with greater emotional well-being, and the former with poorer mental health. A contamination narrative is one where everything is ruined because of X, and the positive inevitably gives way to the negative and becomes irrevocably spoiled or ruined. Unable to extract any good, let alone view the event as positive on balance, this person paints the entire experience with a stained brush. For example, it rained halfway through the picnic and everything got ruined. No thought or mention of any laughter, joy, and conversation up until that point. No talk of reconnecting with an old friend. Any good might be briefly acknowledged and then quickly minimized or mitigated. All sweetness is soured. The totality of the event is recast into a negative experience and recollected as such. In contrast, a redemptive narrative is when we dig deeply to mine the silver lining, even when the situation has an objectively difficult or sad ending. This is not, of course, to say that we look back fondly on every difficulty or feel that, on balance, the good outweighed the bad. Rather, we are able to frame a significant hardship, for example, a personal trauma or illness of a loved one, as the catalyst that ultimately delivers redemption or sweetness. For example, bringing together family or shifting one's perspective to reprioritize one's values. We can also recognize pockets of positivity that foster gratitude. For example, there was no pain. The staff was caring. Or, we were surrounded by family. When a person speaks about his life, the mere ratio of density of positive to negative details and events further unearth his perspective. Intuitively, we recognize that someone's emphasis on the negative speaks to contamination themes, while his emphasis on the positive speaks to redemptive themes. We all know someone who can walk into a room and find the one thing that isn't perfect. He zeroes in on it like a moth to the flame. This is his reality. Negative. By extension, we know that he is generally ungrateful, joyless, and in his interpersonal relationships has a "What have you done for me lately?" attitude. People who share a common worldview have similar language patterns. We are about to see that those who lack perspective speak a language all their own. Absolutely, positively, 100%. In chapter 11, we learned that to feed the illusion of security, the ego is quick to orient our worldview with foregone conclusions and categories. Individuals with a high level of repressed anxiety have a high frequency of dogmatic expressions that feature words such as always, everybody, nobody, totally, necessary, and surely. In contrast, individuals with a low level of anxiety are able to express a more nuanced position by using words such as sometimes, rarely, perhaps, almost, and maybe. In specific instances, the more anxious we are, the more we seek to paper over our insecurities with childlike optimism and certitude. A surgeon is asked, "He's going to be okay, right?" versus, "What's the prognosis?" Intuitively, we know that the first question comes from a scared and concerned party, while the other is from one who is less so. Likewise, which of the following Google searches would be conducted by someone who has already invested in Bitcoin or who very much wants to? A. Will Bitcoin go to $100,000? B. Will Bitcoin go up this year? C. Is Bitcoin a good investment? D. Which cryptocurrency will do best over the next year? Or E. Which is the safest investment? Cryptocurrency, stocks, or real estate? The language of each search tells us who is open to different investment options, who is leaning in one direction, and who has made up her mind and is looking for confirmation that she is correct. In general, the less grounded a person feels, the more she needs to paint her world in black and white. The shape of her own identity becomes fortified by hardening the lines of the world around her. A lack of perspective is typified by absolutist thinking, which is mirrored in someone's speech. Words, expressions, or ideas that denote or symbolize totality in magnitude or probability, or extremism in behavior or beliefs, are considered absolute. Absolutes, for example, all, everything, or complete. Absolute negatives, for example, never, nothing, or nobody. Absolutists typically extrapolate from a single incidence to always because they lack perspective and subsequent context to see the full picture. They also need to be right, which means that coherence trumps truth. Their ability to make associations fit their narratives is nothing short of staggering. Observe how often the person engages in selective memory, like a child who says, "You never let me," as opposed to the healthier and more balanced variation. "Sometimes you don't let me." Another common example might include, "If I don't get this, I'll never be happy." Intensifiers, turning up the heat. The use of abrasive language is characteristic of absolutism. Rather than making a simple, accurate claim, such as, "This clock isn't working anymore," someone says, "The clock is busted to pieces." It's an almost childlike perspective that evokes the image of a tantrum, during which the clock has been thrown around the room and destroyed. Consider the statements, "I really blistered my knees to ribbons," and "My performance has completely devastated the team." They exhibit both absolute, black or white, tendencies, and violent, harsh, or overstated language. "We got into a little tiff," or "We see things differently," is quite different from "We had a huge blowout," or "We went to war over the schedule." Gradations abound. For example, you broke the thing. You busted the thing. You busted the whole thing. You completely busted the whole thing. Or, you completely busted the whole entire damn thing. A person's language pattern is revealing of their personality, and should mental illness emerge, the inevitable trajectory to either ego-dystonic or ego-syntonic disorders, which we covered in Chapter 10. The emotionally unwell submissive type is equally disposed to using intensifiers, but with language that is more in line with a docile, even refined, nature. This produces a language pattern whereby, "I ripped him to pieces in the interview," may sound more like, "I was at my most wonderful best." Sampling a nice ripe apple, the dominant type may declare, "This is the best effing apple." And the submissive type will voice something more akin to, "This is the most glorious apple I ever ate in my entire life." Or, "I could go mad from eating these apples." The use of expletives is similar to that of absolutist words because they commonly work as adverbial intensifiers. Instead of saying or writing, "I'm completely sick of this," a person may instead replace the absolutist word "completely" with a more forceful adverbial intensifier, akin to, "I'm effing sick of this." Certainly, a person is at times entitled to speak emphatically and use sweeping terms and generalities in anger or excitement. By definition, such instances are indicative of a narrowed perspective, and the language accurately signals an individual state. This is normal and understandable. The use of absolute language, like all grammatical indicators, is best observed by noting frequency, duration, intensity, and context to determine if such behavior points to a trait and is declarative of someone's overall perspective and thus mental health. To note that something takes place every day, for example, is not considered absolutist if it does indeed occur every day. For instance, "Every day I do the best I can" is a world away from "every single damn day I do every possible thing I effing can." Context is important too. The language that one uses to claim victory in a professional sports match, an intra-office ping-pong game, or a local bake-off will understandably vary. And touting "complete and total annihilation over those losers" with utter seriousness is less troubling in the context of the WWF than the other two. Similarly, a person in authority, or perhaps one under a time constraint, is under no obligation to sugarcoat an opinion or response. And in such instances, there may be good reason for her to speak in sweeping terms or be excessively blunt. Yet outside of these dynamics, the escalating pattern of judge, jury, and executioner is revealing. When "I don't like cold weather" becomes "no one likes cold weather" or "only idiots like cold weather," we learn a lot more about this person than his dislike for the cold. The judge, jury, and executioner. Someone may very well have busted the entire clock. This statement may or may not be true, as many other expressions of facts and feelings, for example, "I never drive in rush hour traffic," or "Mondays are always my worst day." But absolute language morphs into more pronounced signals of emotional disturbance when our personal assessment, opinion, or judgment becomes not only absolute, but also universal. It should come as no surprise that these language patterns are built on the chassis of egocentricity and the accompanying narrow perspective and low self-esteem. Level 1. Judge. When someone is speaking from a judge perspective, they are essentially projecting their own perspective as objective reality. For example, "This is the best place to vacation." "Everyone likes warm weather." "One cannot manage one's day without a calendar." Or, No one likes super sweet desserts. The judge excludes statements that reflect generally accepted and universal likes and dislikes. For example, no one likes to be taken advantage of. Level 2. Judge and jury. A more troubling perspective distortion is when one becomes judge and jury, both passing judgment and imprinting a moral stamp that labels the goodness or the badness of a person, place, or idea. For example, anyone who likes hot weather is crazy. Or, you're a fool if you don't use an organizer. Recall that the ego secures its footing through the use of definitive conclusions and wide-sweeping categories. Judgmental adjectives, for example, good, dumb, obvious, or maddening, serve both to ground the ego and offer either moral superiority or justification for one's actions. Level 3. Judge, jury, and executioner. Here a person advocates for retribution or justice against those who do not see the world through his lens or who, contrary to his desires and expectations. For example, anyone who doesn't like X is an idiot and should be locked away. Within each level, a verbal intensifier will magnify the distortion. In level 3, for instance, there is a striking distinction between anyone who doesn't like sports is an idiot and should be locked away, and anyone who doesn't like sports is a raging idiot and should be shot in his damn stupid head. Both of these statements indicate a more dominant personality. A persistent pattern of this language personifies an egosyntonic disorder. The submissive counterpart would sound more like, I want zero to do with people who aren't art lovers, and they should all live far away from humanity. The sentiment remains, but the aggression is muted. We already know that we can't make a snap judgment based on one sentence. But sometimes a small grammatical detail bears rich insight, and we may want to probe further when necessary. Once again, factoring frequency, duration, intensity, and context will differentiate state from trait. I'll illustrate with an unfolding dialogue. After taking a bite of dessert, Jane declares aloud, "This is the best cake I've ever tasted." Such a statement is dramatic, but we will allow for the possibility that it may be factual. However, stating, "This will be the best cake you've ever tasted," morphs an opinion, which is by definition subjective, into a fact, and moves Jane into the sphere of judgment. After sampling the dessert, Hannah replies, "It's not bad." As Hannah's response lacks both proper enthusiasm and confirmation of her fact, Jane becomes annoyed. "You don't know what you're talking about." Jane's inability to recognize that her taste buds might not represent all of humanity's is telling, and more so should she designate Hannah to be not just wrong, but also a bad person because she holds a different opinion. We are all entitled to our likes and dislikes, and may believe that others should see things the way that we do. The less healthy a person is, however, the more they need for others to adopt their worldview as their own. In Jane's case, there is little gray area where opposing ideas and beliefs can coexist, because they represent existential threats to her values and belief system, the DNA of her narrative identity. Whatever she holds to be true is who she is and must be protected at all costs. This is who she is, and if you don't like what she likes, then you don't like her. If you don't believe as she does, then, in her egocentricity, whoever is wrong will cease to exist. And it's not going to be her. Let's look more deeply into her psyche. Every picture paints a story. Dining in a restaurant, a person finds their server to be less than friendly. The healthiest perspective is to not take it personally and presume that perhaps she is having a hard day or has a hard life. Either way, the diner is focused on the server's pain and not his own. Remember, however, that a person in emotional pain becomes perpetually self-absorbed. His ego locks his perspective into place, and he cannot get out of his own way and see through another's lens. The following sentiments appear in descending order of gradations of the diner's emotional state and, if the sentiment is part of a pattern, speaks to his overall emotional health. The waitress is rude. All the waitresses in this place are rude. No one in the service industry has any manners. Rude people are what's wrong with this country. Or, rude people should be shot. The pain is intolerable for the person who consistently voices sentiments echoing the fifth response. Outright disrespect or invalidation cuts straight to their core because it is internalized as disconnection, reminding them of their utter unworthiness. Each circumstance we encounter is like a blank book until we write the script with our thoughts. For instance, when someone acts rudely toward us, it doesn't mean anything. This person's words or deeds cause us to feel bad about ourselves, or not, because of our self-image. What does their opinion really have to do with our self-worth? Nothing. But that's just what the ego does. It makes everything about us. The greater our self-esteem, the slower we are to take offense. When we love ourselves, A, we don't assume that someone's actions mean they don't respect us. And B, even if we do come to that conclusion, we aren't emotionally unsettled because we don't need their love or respect in order to feel worthy. We are not in pain because we do not fear disconnection. We are unharmed and then free to recognize the basis for the other person's behavior. That is, their own feelings of inadequacy and insecurity. As self-esteem erodes and the ego engages, we become hyper-alert for anything and anyone who may injure us. We remain on the lookout for any situation that calls into question our worth, fearful that we are not loved and lovable. But this is not simply about vigilance. When the ego is engaged, it means that we are actively focused on the negative. Inevitably, we conclude that all negative experiences are due to a deficiency within ourselves. We draw conclusions that do not mitigate our insecurities and vulnerabilities, but instead feed them. We are looking for signs that we are not worthy of love and respect. If we don't find these signs, we may convince ourselves that we have found them, even in benign comments and happenstance, so that this interpretation fits our narrative. We connect the dots of someone else's behavior to affirm our deepest fear. I am unworthy. Cue anger. Lack of self-worth causes an out-of-proportion response or situation in which we feel disrespected or unloved. The world, funneled through the ego, is our only source of psychological nourishment. When we feel we're not getting the respect we crave, anger and cognitive distortions engage to defend against our feelings of vulnerability. Self-esteem and the ego are inversely related. To the degree that we suffer from low self-esteem, the ego swells and our perspective narrows. Like a seesaw, when one goes up, the other goes down. A person's emotional health is sensibly assessed by observing their perspective and self-esteem. In the next chapter, we will see what real self-esteem looks like and why it is so easily confused with confidence and bravado.